From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Karen and David O'Connor are Olympic medal winners who couldn't have excelled without Prince Panache, Custom Made, and Gilt Edge, their horses. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the O'Connors. As part of the U.S. equestrian team, they won a bronze medal in Sydney. David won an individual gold medal. Also, we meet jazz pianist Bill Sharlop. Sharlop grew up with jazz and show music. His father, Moose Sharlop, wrote most of the songs for the musical Peter Pan. His mother is singer Sandy Stewart. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President-elect Bush said today that he's confident Linda Chavez will be confirmed as Labor Secretary, despite questions over whether she may have violated immigration laws. Chavez has admitted housing and giving money to a woman from Guatemala in the early 1990s, but she said that she didn't know at first that the woman was in the country illegally. Critics have said the woman was essentially a housekeeper who was paid under the table. The woman told the Washington Post that she was not an employee, though Chavez gave her money from time to time. American Airlines may announce this week that it's acquiring TWA. The acquisition is part of a complex package of proposals aimed at strengthening Americans' competitive position. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
American refused to confirm that a deal was being considered, and TWA said only that it was always receptive to legitimate business overtures. Under the terms of the deal, TWA, which has been in financial straits for years, would reportedly declare bankruptcy. Its assets would then be acquired by American, and the TWA name would no longer be used. That means the 76-year-old airline would cease to exist. In addition, American may buy some assets from U.S. Airways after its proposed merger with United. These include some valuable landing slots in the Northeast, which would strengthen its position in the region. If the deals go through, American would bolster its position as one of the country's two largest air carriers, along with United. Together, they would control more than half the air travel market. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Ford Motor Company and Bridgestone Firestone have settled a suit filed by a woman who was paralyzed in a crash involving Firestone tires. 44-year-old Donna Bailey was a passenger in a Ford Explorer that rolled over when the tread separated from a Firestone tire. She was paralyzed from the neck down. The amount of money paid to Bailey was not disclosed. President Clinton is urging the new Congress to boost the minimum wage. NPR's Craig Windham reports.
Mr. Clinton is dispatching U.S. Envoy Dennis Ross to the Middle East this week for separate talks with Israeli and Palestinian officials. In remarks to the Jewish Policy Forum in New York, Mr. Clinton detailed key elements of his proposed framework for a peace accord. While the plan is fair, he said, it will entail real pain and sacrifice for both sides. But he added, the benefits are far more significant. To the people of Israel, Mr. Clinton said, your land was also the Palestinians' homeland. He added, the hard reality is there is no choice but to divide this land into two states for two people. Mr. Clinton also urged the Palestinians to accept his proposal for a negotiated settlement instead of holding out for what he called the impossible more. Craig Windham, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks, the Dow lost 40 points today to close at 10,621. This is NPR News. The Supreme Court has agreed to consider a case that could affect how much states can regulate commercial speech. The suit was filed by cigarette and cigar makers who say the state of Massachusetts violated their free speech rights by limiting where they can put advertising billboards and indoor signs. A newly elected New Hampshire lawmaker is offering to resign. Tom Alsier raised a controversy with his anti-police views. New Hampshire Public Radio's Mark Beavis reports from Concord.
Newly elected State Representative Tom Alsier's offer to resign comes with a price. The Nashville Republican gained notoriety last week for his internet postings advocating the killing of police officers. Alsier is demanding that other New Hampshire lawmakers make sure the bills he sponsored reforming the state's legal code make it to the House floor.
If a sufficient number of my fellow representatives go on the record pledging that they shall perform these simple parliamentary roles, then I will happily give up my fancy new license plates. Mission accomplished.
Al-Sir, however, reserved the right to run in the special election that would be held to fill his seat. The Republican leadership was reportedly unaware of Al-Sir's offer, and Democrat Governor Jean Shaheen said Al-Sir misled voters and should resign without conditions. For NPR News, I'm Mark Beavis in Concord, New Hampshire.
A judge in Baton Rouge has sentenced former Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards to 10 years in prison for racketeering and extortion. A lawyer for Edwards said it's essentially a death penalty for his 73-year-old client. Edwards was convicted in May of extorting hundreds of thousands of dollars from people seeking licenses for riverboat gambling casinos. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Ken Burns' Story of American Music. Jazz premieres tonight at 9 Eastern on PBS stations. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
80 seconds gone. He's got the time in hand. One jump to go for gold. And there it is. David O'Connor under the time. One rail down. He is the gold medalist. Looks like David can't believe it.
Altogether for this combination, the last combination on the course as they approach the...
Incredibly, Karen O'Connor gets the third fastest time of the day, saving U.S. medal hopes.
At the Olympics in Sydney last September, my guests David and Karen O'Connor were part of the U.S. equestrian team that won the bronze medal for the three-day event. This made them the first husband and wife team to twice share an Olympic medal. Also in Sydney, David became the first American in 26 years to win the gold medal for the individual three-day equestrian event. He had the best score in Olympic history. We invited the O'Connors to talk with us about horses, the Olympics, and how being married affects their ability to compete together. They've been married about 7 years and live in Virginia. The three-day events they competed in include dressage, cross-country, and stadium jumping. I asked the O'Connors if they thought of themselves and their horses as athletes.
We have this kind of way of thinking about it that in training, basically it's kind of 75% rider and 25% horse. And on the day of the competition, it really kind of reverses itself. So over the months and years that it takes to prepare for an Olympic Games or really any international competition, you really are honing your skills personally as an athlete. You don't see anybody that is not fit in our sport. And the same thing with the horses. Our horses are treated totally as athletes from every aspect, from nutrition, their fitness programs, their physiology. It's an amazing how technical it's become, especially, I would say, in the last 10 years with some revolutions in of how bodies work within themselves, and we've applied that to the equine sciences.
Karen, you know when you're competing and you know what's at stake in the Olympics. You know today is the Olympic event. But what about the horse? Does the horse realize this is a special event? Everything's at stake?
I think there's no question that the horse, he experiences an adrenaline rush in various aspects of his life. And these horses that we would have at the Olympic Games, we would probably have been riding them for a number of years. The horse I rode, Prince Panache, I've been with him for 9 years. And within that period of time, that's a large portion of his life where he has been a competitive athlete. And so he's quite competitive, quite enthusiastic about his game. And so when he gets to a competition site, the amount of atmosphere at that site is a bit of a barometer to how he's going to react to it. And I think that at the Olympic Games, there is not another competition that has the hype that the Olympic Games themselves have. And the horses, they have a very clear reading on that. They're amazing on how much they can take in.
I'd like you to each describe the horse that you rode in the Olympics and the personality of the horse.
I rode a horse that I've been riding for 8 or 9 years now. His name is Prince Panache, and he was born in England, and that's where I purchased him along with his owner, Mrs. Jacqueline Mars, and she had purchased the horse so that I could compete him. His personality, he's a very, very distinguished gentleman and always has been. If he was to wear clothing, he would always be in Armani suits and have his shoes would be impeccably shined whenever he went out. He's very articulate about everything he does and very businesslike. He's a very loving horse and a horse what I would call has a big heart, meaning that if you ask him to do something, he will always give you 110% effort, which is a quality that is always something we want to look for in a competition horse, is a horse that really, really enjoys his work to the point where he never feels like he's trying hard enough. He always wants to try harder for you, and that's a wonderful thing to have been a part of a horse's life like that.
I rode two horses in the Olympic Games, one horse called Gilt Edge and another one, the gold medal horse, was a horse named Custom Made, and they're very, very different personalities. Gilt Edge is a technician. He would be the semi geek. he would always be working on the computer, and he studies his sport very down to the last detail. And he has been one of the most successful horses in the United States in the last 30 years. This is his fifth medal in Olympic or World Championship or Pan American Games. And he is by far done that because of his desire to play. He loves to compete, and he's a technician. He would know exactly how fast he's going and where his feet are going to go and all that. He has that type of attitude. The other horse that I have, Custom Made, who we call Taylor, is all flair. He is a very big jumper. He loves to run fast. He loves to get semi near the fence and just leave the ground and doesn't really care where he lands. He's very much a showman. The interesting thing about it, he's got really two sides to his personality, because his private side in his stable and in his stall, he really doesn't want to talk to a lot of other people. He looks, you know, grumpy. He looks like, you know, the Grinch. And when you get him out in the front of the public in any type of competition, he is all show. And then this other personality kind of blossoms out of him, and he's very much of a ham, and an actor in that way. So he is all flair and all, you know, bravado and all talk, and the other one's all technician. It's they're very, very interesting horses to be around.
Now, I think in the stadium jumping, the horse has never seen the course, but you're given a chance to walk through it, so you know what you're up against.
Yes, that's right, and that'd be true also in the cross country phase as well. Mm-hmm. The horses would never have seen the cross country course, but you have the ability to walk it as many times as you like.
So, what kind of mental calculations are you making when you're looking at the course before competing on it?
Well, you first in your first couple of walkings of the cross country course, you're just becoming familiar with the course itself, and it takes you probably two walkings before you can really have it in your mind which jump comes after which, the succession of the jumps, how they're numbered, because there are usually 30 efforts on the course, and within those 30 efforts there are probably 50 to 60 jumping efforts for the horse, because some of the numbered jumps have two or three jumping efforts. They're combinations, as we call them, of jumps. And so how we kind of break it down is, once we get familiar with the course, then we start to get very familiar with the lay of the land and where every lump and bump and blade of grass is on the course. And then we have to start breaking that course down in one-minute increments, because it is a timed event, and the time plays a very big key role in the overall outcome. And so we would measure the course with a wheel. It's all done in the metric system, and we would measure that at the specific speed that we're required to go the cross country at, and then from there we break down the minutes, and we get a very clear idea as to what minutes take a long time, what minutes we're going to go by very quickly, so that we are within 1 or 2 seconds of where we want to be during the 13 minutes of that course.
David, when you're about to jump, what are you thinking? What's going through your mind?
I hope he jumps high enough. I think you don't really, it's not that sense. It's you have a tremendous confidence in what the horses can do and what you have done, and your training have lead you to that point where it's not a conscious effort of trying to make them jump. You don't make the horses jump in this aspect. You get them there right. You get them there at a certain speed. You get them there, and it's with helping with their balance. And it's their job to jump, and you get to enjoy that process as it goes on. So it's not so much, you know, that you're thinking one specific thing. Like you would ask a soccer player, what is he thinking just as he's about to kick a ball? I would, you know, I don't think it's a conscious level at that point.
No, I know if I were jumping, which I wouldn't be, that just as we got, you know, to the obstacle, I would be tensing my body and thinking, uh-oh. No, tensing your body is probably the last thing you want to do as a horse is about to jump.
Yeah, it's exactly right. I mean, in that situation, we're, because of our experience, are at a level where you really, you don't, as the horse is going to take off, you don't think of whether the horse is going to jump or if he's going to jump. You're only trying to help him jump better. So there's not that nervous feeling at all in this level of sport.
Now, David, you said something like you have to get the horse right to the jump. What are you looking for in getting the pacing right and making sure that, that they're in the right at the right distance from the obstacle before the horse has to jump over it?
The easiest way to explain how a rider helps a horse in with his jumping is there's certain things that the rider has control over. One is the speed, and the other is what we call the striding. And the example that you could use from a just our point of view is that if you are running across the street and we're going to jump up to a jump even step up onto a curb, you would adjust your footfall in order to so that you would step up onto that curb correctly
and not run into it.
And not run into it. Well, the horse does the same thing when he's going to jump, and a rider can sense where that is. Do you need to expand your stride? Do you need to compress the stride in order to help you get to that place? To jump at the best way possible. And that is a feeling that has developed over the years. And you can do that with a horse and help him. Your job as a rider is to help him make whatever's going to happen happen better. So your job is to make the jump happen better by helping him lengthen or helping him shorten or not letting him go from one side to the other, not letting him drift, keeping your direction. In that part, it's very simple in its idea, though a little bit hard to explain, I think, when you're doing it.
And the other thing is that remembering that the horse has not seen the jump or the course at all, and so we have all of the information to be able to direct him in a way that he then, when he leaves to jump the jump, we would know how big the drop is, we would know what's on the other side, we would know if there's a jump on the other side. That would enable us to be able to place him perfectly so that he does it very easily. Now, that our job ends up being to make it simplistic for the horse. That takes quite a lot of complexity to be able to do that.
Have either of you been injured in a fall?
Yeah, both of us have, broken bones and done some damage internally. I've had a punctured lung before, and Karen's had a she tore a hole in her kidney once because a horse kneeled on her as it was getting up. And so we have spent our time in the hospital. and I think, as we say, that is something that you don't dwell on. It's not something that I think about every day. I don't think Karen thinks about it every day.
Yeah, I don't think about it much at all, really.
Yeah, it's just I think that's part of life. You can't make any sport, and especially a sport like this, safer than life itself. And so that's part of what we accept.
What's the technique you have to learn to fall in such a way that you're not likely to injure yourself?
Well, I think when you're a child, in school, we go through tumbling. And that's very much an exercise for children to be able to carry throughout their whole life on how to dissipate any kind of concussive effort. In other words, the act of tumbling, jumping off something into a roll, is a safe way for a person to fall. And I think that the experts would say that they're trying to prepare the child for their first fall off a bicycle or the first fall on a pair of skis or whatever. And, that certainly follows true to our sport. When you fall off of a horse, the most important aspects of it are to not brace against that fall. In fact, we try to roll out of the fall, one, so that your joints are getting a much easier cushion and more of a trampoline effect. And then the second one, of course, you want to roll out of the path of the horse because in many times, most cases, the actual fall of the rider really doesn't injure the rider. But one thing that can injure the rider is if the horse runs over the top of you. So that comes right back to being able to tuck and roll as you fall and just roll away from where the situation is.
But I must say that one of the techniques you're also trying to do is try to not get yourself into a place where you're going to fall off in the first place.
Right.
That's a big deal.
Sure.
My guests are equestrian Olympic medal winners David and Karen O'Connor. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are David and Karen O'Connor. At the Olympics in Sydney last September, they became the first married couple to have twice shared a medal. They were part of the team that won a bronze for the three-day equestrian event. David won a gold medal for the individual three-day equestrian event. David, during one of the feature interviews with you this past summer during the Olympics on TV, you and your mother told the story about how she took you and your brother cross-country by horse when you were a kid. And during this cross-country trip on horseback, you were, I guess, on a road, and there was a big truck coming at you. Would you tell the story?
Yeah, we were in Nebraska, and we had been invited, actually. When we were out in Nebraska and Wyoming, you'd be on the same road, obviously, for a long time, days and almost weeks, and so people kind of find out that you were coming. And so we got an invitation, and it ended up being a little bit farther off the road than we thought, and we ended up riding at night. And we were on a bridge, actually, and it was quite a long bridge, you know, I would say a quarter mile or so. And it was pitch dark, and I was in the front, and it was a small road off of the major interstate that goes through the middle of Nebraska. And this truck comes rolling off the highway, and of course he doesn't see anything on the bridge. We're just kind of riding along there, and he's driving right down the middle of the bridge, going, you know, lickety split. And he didn't see us until the very, very end, and swerved over to the other lane. And where we were, it was a very narrow bridge, and so there was no room to get off. We couldn't get off onto the sidewalk. We couldn't do that. It was just the railing, and it was a long drop all the way down to, I don't even know if it was over a river or over a gully. We never, because it was dark, we never really got to see it. And I still have this image of this truck, you know, barreling down on you and having it pass you, and, you know, seeing the rivets of the truck. You know how when you get into a dangerous situation, a lot of times time slows down. And I still have that image in my head 20-some-odd years later of the rivets in the truck passing you by, feeling like they were just literally inches. And the most amazing thing really is the horses. They never missed a step. You think about it, I could never do that on the horses that I have right now. But these horses had already been, you know, 1,500 or 1,800 miles by the time they had been there, and they were pretty used to a lot of different situations. And they never missed a step. They just kept walking on a straight line, any kind of shying one way or the other, and we would have been killed. There's no doubt about that, that it was that close. It was amazing, really, thinking about it years afterwards, that the horses didn't react at all. They just kept walking straight down the line. They knew that that was the only way out, and that's what happened.
Did your mother give you any advice? Did she holler anything as the truck was approaching?
Yeah, she was just screaming at me, you know, just about keeping him straight and keep going forward, because we didn't have anywhere else to go. It was a pretty nerve-wracking moment, and it's one of the things that stays out in my head, obviously for a big part of the trip, but the whole trip was quite an experience, and there were a lot of different situations, good, bad, and not so great to be in. But overall, the trip, you know, made a tremendous impression on my life, because we stayed with the richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor, and really had a tremendous appreciation about how people in all walks of life make a living and scratch out a living in agriculture and in towns. It was quite an amazing deal.
And he was only, what, 11 years old?
I was only 11 years old.
Karen, do men and women ride differently? Is there like a different posture or different style for men and women?
Well, it's a good question. There certainly is not a different posture, even though the anatomy is quite different. Funny enough, the way a person sits on a horse does not change whether you're male or female. I would say that the only difference is the strength issue. Men are stronger than women. There's just no getting around that. So the variety of horses that a man can ride might vary, that they can ride a horse that can become quite strong to ride, whereas a woman has the advantage that they, being a little bit smaller, can ride a smaller size of horse. So I think the strengths and weaknesses to each of the sexes balance themselves out. And on the day, it is the only Olympic sport in the Summer Games where men and women compete equally against each other. And it is very true that they have a level playing field with one another, and it's fascinating to be a part of that. And there's no question that women are equally as talented and strong enough to do this job as men are back and forth.
You were both on the team that won the bronze medal at the Olympics this past summer for the three-day equestrian event. And you were, I think, only the second husband and wife team to share a podium for the same medal in Olympic history. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like to be on the podium together for the same event?
Well, this is the second time, really, we've been on the podium together, because in Atlanta we won the team silver medal. And at that moment in time in Atlanta, when we stepped up on the podium, it was a very, very quiet moment for us. That we really were not sure we were ever going to be able to repeat again, because it's such a special moment and such an unusual moment. And then to have it happen again 4 years later, one of the most significant moments in your sporting career, and the person that you want to share it with the most is literally standing right next to you and is a part of that. It's a great moment personally within our sporting lives. And now we have 4 years to see if we could do it again. It's pretty exciting to think of the prospects of it.
David and Karen O'Connor are Olympic medal winners. They'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. And from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet pianist Bill Sharlip. We're listening to him now. And we continue our conversation with equestrians Karen and David O'Connor. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with David and Karen O'Connor. At the Olympics in Sydney last September, they became the first married couple to twice share a medal. They were part of the team that won a bronze for the three-day equestrian event. Their team won a silver in 96. Also in Sydney, David won a gold medal for the individual three-day equestrian event. Do you ever get competitive with each other?
We're sitting there looking at each other, wondering who's going to answer that one. riding is a lot like golf in the way that it's a very individualistic sport, and you practice your own techniques, and you're competing with your horse against the course, against the clock, against all this kind of stuff. And so you're not so much competitive with any other one person, even whether you're married to them or not. It's not that type of sport. So I don't think that we have that same level of competitiveness of, let's say, track and field or swimming, where you just are faster or stronger or whatever than, or
it's
you
not
can
head
you
to
can
head
jump
competition.
Yeah, because it's not head to head, you feel that you don't have that level of competitiveness. But we are extremely competitive people and competitive about ourselves. And so what we expect of ourselves individually is very, very high. And that is a constant part of our kind of communication and our talking between ourselves and, you know, in our relationship.
How do you prevent that from getting in the way of the relationship?
We have rules. We have definitely rules. And one of the major rules is that both Karen and I were international level competitors before we got married. And one of the major rules is not trying to make the other person what you are, you know, with technique. And so in that, we do not give each other an opinion unless if it's asked for. And if it's asked for, then you have to be willing to hear it. But you don't offer one unless if it's asked for.
And if it's asked for, what if the opinion isn't very good? I mean, will you give that honestly?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
That you have to. Because
that's the rule.
You're at a
point.
That's the rule.
That's the rule.
Because you have to, because at that point, that means the person is stuck about what they believe in. And so you have to give your honest opinion. Otherwise, you know, it's not going to help the other person get ready for the competition at all.
And if the other person's squirming because they don't really want to hear that, then, of course, you know, we remind each other of the rule.
One of the biggest things that why I think it does work so is we're two individual people going down the same road. We're not trying to be one person. And because we're going down the road, we can really enjoy how the other person competes, when they compete. And the only, it's not about who wins and who loses. It's about the hardest day is when somebody is winning or second or third or whatever up in the top, and somebody else has a disastrous day in that they fall off or they have, that's the much harder situation to deal with than one person's first and one person's third, because then it really does make a lot of difference in the long term.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. So how do you feel, how do you deal with your exhilaration at having won a race while your partner has fallen that day?
Well, we drive different vehicles home.
Seriously?
I mean, well, the problem is we drive different vehicles there because we got so many horses and so many vehicles to take.
Right.
It's taking the circus on the road, that's for sure.
Yeah, we definitely have a crew. We're like running a Formula One team. You know, there's a lot of trucks on the road when we go. I think in that situation is we have learned, and you learn that because of experience, because you've been in the situation a number of times, and we've been at this a long time. That the highs are not as high as they used to be when they were younger, because you don't feel like your life is going to make or break whether you win one competition or not. So your highs are not quite as high, which puts then your lows not as low, and you try to keep everything in the middle ground. And that's really how you deal with it, is that tomorrow is always another day. There's always another competition. And when we start to look up on our wall and see the things that we've won and the trophies that we won, it's amazing. You sit there in your living room and you're saying, now, when did I, that was 95. No, actually, it fell off in 95. That was 96. And it puts it into a long-term perspective. It seemed very important at the time. But when you get to walk away from it, it loses part of its kind of special moment,
the
intensity of the moment.
How big a team do you take with you to competitive events?
There are roughly about six or seven people that go on the road with us when we're competing a lot of horses. At the Olympic Games, we would have a person per horse that would take care of that, plus blacksmith, vets, physiotherapist, an administrator for the team, a massage therapist. We actually even use acupuncture. And so on a trip like the Olympic Games, you can literally have 10 or 15 people that are extra besides you and your horse. On a private basis, when we're competing, we take four or five people on the road with us because most of the time we're competing three or four horses together. And so it really is a tremendous crew. That doesn't count the crew that we have at home plus the crew that we have in the office. I mean, it's a very, very big group.
Is the acupuncture for you or for the horse?
For the horse. And it's amazing what it does.
Well, tell me about it.
It's the same thing. It works on the same lines as what it does with people, about pain relief for muscles. And it has an amazing effect, along with massage therapy. So we really do the same level of care, especially preventative care, as any marathon runner or any track and field star would. And that really what it takes to keep a competitive athlete at the top of their game.
The horse can't say, it hurts over here.
They can't. They don't tell you. They obviously can't tell you in words, but they do tell you of soreness. That's part of the rider's job, is to always feel how a horse is working and how a horse is feeling.
Have you ever had to put a horse you love down?
Sure. You know, horses, you can't control everything. Just like people, they get sick, and if they have an injury, or sometimes they don't make it. So we've had isolated instances of horses that have had to be put down over the last 20 years, but I think we could probably count them on, you know, one hand. So we feel very lucky that with the people that work with us on the team, in this Formula One team, as we call it, we have very, very good management, and the percentage of injury or sickness with our horses has been very, very small, and we feel very lucky about that.
But make no mistake, I mean, it's crushing when it happens. You feel like a personality that you have been working with for over the years is now gone. And that, with any type of situation, is devastating. And you feel a big hole of your life, and that hole in some ways gets filled up by other things, but it's never totally filled up.
And we're as close to these horses as we are to our closest friends. And so if one of them dies, and of course we have horses that die of old age as well, that's a friend, and that's a good friend. And it's a time to mourn and a time to be very reflective on the passage of time that you were able to have with that animal.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having us. It's been a pleasure.
It's been fun.
Karen and David O'Connor are Olympic medal winners. Coming up, pianist Bill Sharlop. This is Fresh Air.
Bill Sharlop is a pianist who was described as a lyrical repository by New Yorker jazz critic Whitney Balliot. In a 1999 profile, Balliot wrote that Sharlop was the best but least well-known of a swarm of gifted pianists who have appeared in New York in the past 10 years. He has already filled much of the sizable space once occupied by Bill Evans. Sharlop grew up with jazz and show music. His father, Moose Sharlop, wrote many of the songs for the Broadway musical Peter Pan. His mother is singer Sandy Stewart. Sharlop has recorded several CDs that reveal his knowledge of standards and obscure jazz and pop songs. Before we meet him, let's hear a track from his new CD, Written in the Stars. This is the Frank Lesser song, On a Slow Boat to China. Thank you.
Bill Charlap, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. It's a pleasure to be here.
How did you develop your interest in songs and theater music?
Well, I didn't really develop it. It just was always there. You know, that's really pretty much how anything has developed for me. It's basically something that I like, that's all. Of course, I developed it because my mother is a professional singer and a wonderful singer who sang with Benny Goodman and recorded in the 60s an album that was Grammy nominated called My Coloring Book. And she was a regular on the Perry Como show, the Mitch Miller show. So she was really a pop singer of her generation, like a Rosemary Clooney, someone like that. A pop singer who sings the melody but swings. And my dad, Moose Charlap, who died when I was 7 years old, was a composer of popular songs and mostly, however, theater music. He's most known for most of the music to the Mary Martin Peter Pan songs like I've Got a Crow, I'm Flying, Tender Shepherd, and I Won't Grow Up. That's all my dad. So I grew up with those songs as a central focus in my home.
So those songs were all around you when you were growing up, theater songs and the pop songs of that period.
They were, and so were the composers and lyricists who wrote them. Yep Harburg used to come by our house. Charles Strauss was around. Marilyn and Alan Bergman, many more. Just people that I didn't really recognize were these people at the time. That they were just, it's your Uncle Yip.
So when you were starting to play piano, were you know how a lot of kids when they take piano lessons are expected to like perform for the relative, show off a little bit?
Yes.
Were you encouraged to do that when Yip Harburg was over and all these great composers and lyricists?
I didn't need any encouragement.
You were a ham?
Well, you know, I'm a performer. There must be some want to perform there, you know. But it wasn't really like that. It was more like an acceptance of, oh, this is what he does, you know. It wasn't really like, wow, it's so special, perhaps, though I did feel the support of my parents. It was more like, well, this is just what he does.
How come Julie Stein and Comden and Green wrote Never Neverland, which is also from Peter Pan?
Yes, and a magnificent song. My father was a very young man when he was hired to write the music for Peter Pan with Carolyn Lee, who went on to become a very famous lyricist, but she was unknown as well. She's written, you know, many songs, Cy Coleman and many others. In any event, my father was very young at the time. And the producers got a little bit skittish as they were doing the out-of-town trials. And they felt, well, you know, we have this unknown composer and unknown lyricist on this, and even though they're wonderful, we really need to get a big name in on this. So they hired Julie Stein and Betty Comden and Adolph Green to write what's now called in the program Additional Songs By.
Got it. Well, I want to play a song that your father wrote called I Was Telling Him About You. And this version is featured on a recording that your mother, Sandy Stewart, made a few years ago, in which you're featured on piano and your brother, Tom Charlap, is featured on bass. What are your memories of this song?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't really have memories of it from my youth. Again, that song was a hit, I think, before I was born. I got to know it later because of my mother and some recordings of things like Joe Williams recorded it. And
Betty Carter
recorded it. Johnny Mathis recorded it. I've just found that. Marvin Gaye recorded it, of all things.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I just found that out from Kenny Washington the other day. He was playing it on his radio show. So many people have recorded that song, and it's just a lovely lyric, a very original tune, and one of my father's only hit pop tunes. It wasn't written for a show. It isn't theater music. It was just a popular song. And it was nice recording this, too, because I had my brother on bass, and my mother was remarried to a man called George Trufant, who plays trumpet on this track. And a dear friend of mine called Ron Vincent, who played drums on here.
So this is the Moose Charlap melody I was telling him about you from the Sandy Stewart album, Sandy Stewart and Family, my guest Bill Charlap featured at the piano. To mention that the lyric of that song is written by Don George. The recording we just heard was made in 1993. It must be really interesting to play with your mother singing.
Well, you know, every child has a feeling when they hear their mother's voice speak, if you know what I mean. I mean, that's the original voice that you heard. And it's nice to have your mother sing you to sleep. But in my case, my mother's a professional singer, so when I hear her voice, it, besides that she is really a magnificent singer by anybody's estimation, for me, it's special hearing my mother's voice sing so beautifully. So, yes, it is special playing for her, and I've learned a great deal about phrasing from her. She's one of the great phrasers and a real professional too. My mother, when you're working with her as a singer, she's one of the boys in the best sense, in that she really is an incredibly low maintenance professional musician. So it's great to play with her.
You know, I saw your mother in a rock and roll movie, and I can't remember the title of it because all those great rock and roll movies just kind of blend together after a while.
Go Johnny Go.
There
she
you
was
go.
Julie Melody.
Were you very amused the first time you saw your mother in a rock and roll movie?
Sure, I got a huge kick out of it. Are you kidding me? My mother in a Chuck Berry movie? She sang Little Playmate in it with a rockabilly beat. You know, the reason for that is it was public domain and they could use a song like that and they didn't have to pay anybody. But she's the female lead in that show, which is about talented yet juvenile delinquent guitarist who she falls in love with. Now, when we say juvenile delinquent, we mean that he, I don't know, I think he may have smoked a cigarette once and drank half a beer and cut school. It's a different type of juvenile delinquent in the 1950s.
My guest is pianist Bill Charlap. His new CD is called Written in the Stars. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is pianist Bill Charlap. He has a new CD called Written in the Stars. How does your life as a musician compare to the lives you saw around you from the music world when you were growing up?
Well, it's similar in some ways, but quite different in others. Neither of my parents were really jazz musicians. My father wasn't really a singer or a player, yet he could really sell a song. Other composers used to hire him to do backers auditions because he had such a intensity and, you know, a real salesmanship. But the thing that is similar for me is the work ethic that particularly I saw in my father, because it's the idea of, well, we need a song that tells you about the female lead, about the subplot of the story that brings you from this scene to this scene, and that is a waltz and that has a dance number in it, and we need it by 3 o'clock today. So it's not about sitting around and waiting for the inspiration. I can't create under these conditions. It's about being able to get to that place, and that's craftsmanship. And I think that one has to get their craftsmanship to the highest level before you can really just think about letting go. And I'm always still working on it. So in that way, it's similar. But in other ways, it's quite a different lifestyle. I perform and I travel and I record and I'm improvising all the time and I'm not a composer. So I think that it's quite different. It's probably more similar to how my mother's lifestyle was when she was performing.
Why don't we close with something else from your new CD, Written in the Stars. Why don't we close with the Gershwin song, Lorelei? You want to say anything about it?
Well, this is an unique tune, particularly how it comes out of the bridge. You really have a stroke of genius with Gershwin there. You know, one of the things about George Gershwin is that there's always some little stroke of genius somewhere that you think, now, my God, nobody else could possibly have thought of how to get from there to there. Nobody would come up with anything as good either, or with such a naturalness, yet something so interesting. I will say one other thing, and I met Julie Stein years after my father died, and he told me something really great, which I think you could say about a great jazz solo as well. He said, the secret of writing a popular song is that it be melodically simple and harmonically attractive. Now, I love what he said there. It's not so simple, because he didn't say harmonically complex or even harmonically interesting. He just said harmonically attractive. And that sort of tells you everything, you know. I thought that was a great premiere on how to make something with meaning out of the least amount of materials, which is a good deal of what it's about for me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Bill Charlap's new CD is called Written in the Stars. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, and Dorothy Farabee. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci, 7 Steps to Everyday Genius by Michael J. Gelb, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, former FDA Commissioner David Kessler talks about his fight to regulate the tobacco industry. His new memoir is called A Question of Intent, A Great American Battle with a Deadly Industry. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.